suddenly decided she was an expert on when bombs can go off and when they can't? The clamor grew more raucous as the mob egged me on. And then, out of nowhere, came the music. Some crazy son of a bitch in the horde of well-wishers had a saxophone, and I heard those stirring opening notes to Theme from Rocky. Hero music. But I didn't feel heroic. I felt like an idiot. Kylie's words raced through my brain. Segura can't blow up anything without a cell signal, and guess what they have on the ESU truck? A cell jammer. My gut reaction when she said it was to try to stop her from using the jammer illegally. What I should have said was, how do you know Segura can't blow anything up without a cell signal? What if he has a computer rigged with a backup detonator? What if he has a high-powered rifle and he shoots me for trying to save the man who cost him 20 years of his life? But I hadn't questioned her logic. And now I was putting my ass on the line to save one of the biggest dirtbags on the planet. Nathan Hirsch sat staring at his dead cell phone, probably wondering if Segura was going to call him back or blow him up. He was a dozen steps up from street level, dead center between two massive Corinthian columns. The towering temple of justice loomed behind him. I wanted to bound up the stairs two at a time, but as soon as my foot hit the first step, everything seemed to slow down. It was like that recurring dream where you're running, 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 but you feel like you're barely moving. Maybe it was the jet lag. Maybe it was the abject fear fucking with my head. But it seemed to take a lifetime for my foot to touch the second step. Someone had found a way to amp up the sound of the sax, and with the music blaring and the crowd chanting, I made it to the third step, and the fourth. Days later, I would watch some of the many videos of my climb up those courthouse steps. On film, it only took seconds. But in real life, my entire world was in slow motion. Nathan, don't move! I called out as I got closer. He looked up when he heard me. Cates had guessed right. Hirsch had pissed himself. And he was crying. Please, God, I thought. Don't let this fat bastard be the last thing I ever see during my time here on Earth. Hold still, I said, lowering his cuffed wrist so I could rest the briefcase on the steps. I took a look at the bolt cutters I'd been dragging along like an appendage. They were a flimsy government-issue piece of crap, and I remember John Glenn's famous words. As I hurtled through space, one thought kept crossing my mind. Every part of this rocket was supplied by the lowest bidder. Somewhere in my pocket was a key ring with half a dozen keys on it, one of which might open the cuffs. Or it might not. I hoped I didn't have to find out. I opened the bolt cutters wide, positioned the blades over two steel links, and with every ounce of strength I had left in my travel-weary body, I slammed the two handles together. The chain snapped.
Run, Nathan, run!
I commanded. He didn't. Or maybe he couldn't. He froze. And he was too fat to carry. I grabbed him by both arms, pulled him toward me, and put my mouth to his ear. Listen to me, asshole. I've got a girlfriend I'm going home to. You either move or you can stay here and die. He moved. He navigated the steps like a pregnant sow, and I braced myself for the explosion that would hurl the two of us into the federal court building on the other side of Lafayette. It never came. No boom. Just the whoops of the onlookers as I helped the gasping lawyer waddle across Center Street toward the bedlam and finally passed him into the arms of a team of uniformed cops. Have the paramedics check him out, I said, but don't let him wander off until he has a heart-to-heart with Selma Kaplan at the DA's office. One of the cops put her hand on my shoulder. What about you? She said. You okay? I'm fine. Just get me away from these fucking cameras. I followed her to a mobile command center that was parked on Worth Street, stumbled in the door, shut it behind me, dropped to my knees, and half sobbing, half laughing, I thanked a god I hadn't been in touch with for longer than I care to admit. Chapter 53. There were four white-shirted cops in the command center. Brass. Two of them were barking into satellite phones. I'd picked the wrong place to duck into for quiet reflection. I took a few slow, deep breaths, centered myself, and looked up. One of the white shirts was looming over me. I recognized her immediately. Barbara O'Brien, a public information officer. I stood up.
"You've got balls, Detective Jordan," she said.
Coming from anyone else, that would have felt like a compliment, but not from her. I nodded, waiting for the other shoe to drop.
"You got a warrant to go with those balls?" she said.
"Ma'am?"
"You disabled the cell phone service for tens of thousands of civilians. The press is going to ask me if you came up with that little rescue mission on your own, or did you have a signed warrant?"
"I believe my partner was working on a warrant."
"Working on? For your sake, let's hope she got it."
"Lieutenant, I have to go. Captain Cates is expecting to hear from me."
"Tell her she'll be hearing from me, too."
I'd walked into the command center to the sound of a cheering crowd. I walked out a minute later at the top of somebody's shit list. Within seconds after I stepped back outside, the crowd let out another joyful roar. But this one wasn't for me. Their cell phones had come back on.
"I see that you restored their cell service," I said to Kylie as she made her way toward me.
"It's more like I restored their lives," she said. "Another few minutes without a dial tone, and these people would have gotten ugly."
"So now the bomb is hot again."
"No problem. The guys in the bomb squad live for that shit. They'll be fighting to see who gets to disarm it. Besides, Segura's not going to set it off without anyone to blow up. Now that he's got a cell signal again, he'll probably call back and congratulate you.
As will I."
She threw her arms around me.
"You're a hero, partner."
"I don't think so," I said. "But I need the hug."
"You don't think so?
Zach, just because people couldn't make phone calls doesn't mean they couldn't shoot videos. That 100-yard mad dash of you running toward a bomb will be all over the internet. By this time tomorrow, you'll be a YouTube sensation. You risked your life to save someone most people wouldn't think was worth saving. Trust me, you're a rock star."
"Tell that to PIO O'Brien. I just ran into her in the command center."
"And what did that hard-ass want?"
"An inquiry into why two cops violated a federal law that prohibits police departments from operating a cell jammer without express authorization."
"And what makes you think we don't have authorization?"
"Because we don't."
"But we will in a minute."
"From who?"
"From the randy old coot who took me to dinner at the Harvard Club, and who after two glasses of wine said to me, 'If you ever need a favor, sweetheart, here's my cell number.'"
"Judge Rafferty," I said.
"I think the old boy has a crush on me."
"You're telling me you called him on his personal phone and got a warrant?"
"Verbal. I'm going over to the courthouse now to get it on paper."
"You mean you're going over there hoping to convince him to give you a warrant after the fact?"
"Shut up and follow me. But we better go around the back way. That pesky bomb is blocking the front door."
5 minutes later, we were escorted into Judge Rafferty's chambers. "Kylie," he said, coming around his desk and giving her a hug, "I've got your warrant right here."
"Ye of little faith," she said to me, grabbing the document that would exonerate us from the wrath of O'Brien and prosecution by the feds.
"And you, young man," the judge said, shaking my hand. "I thought you were kind of a dolt at first, but I've come around."
"Zach Jordan," I said, hoping he'd eventually remember my name.
"Thank you, sir."
"By the way, Your Honor," Kylie said, "we've just arrested the two scoundrels who were blackmailing you."
"That calls for a drink," he said,
opening his desk drawer. "We're still on duty, sir," Kylie said, "but we'll take a rain check."
"I'll hold you to it," he said. "But we'll have to have two drinks, one for the blackmailers and one for Zach's masterful performance. I watched it on TV. It was textbook police work, son. I wouldn't change a thing."
"Oh, I'd definitely change one thing, sir."
"And what's that?"
"I'd have Wynton Marsalis on trumpet instead of that damn saxophone player."
Chapter 54. We were on our way back to the precinct when Cates called. I put her on speaker.
"I just got off the phone with Barbara O'Brien," she said.
"What does she want?" I said. "My badge or my balls?"
"She told me she tore into you, but she's changed her tune now that the bomb is disabled and you somehow magically came up with a warrant." Now she wants me to put you both up for a commendation.
We'll settle for a day off, Kylie said.
It's not in the cards. I need your asses back here. Your two drone bandits lawyered up. ADA Kaplan is trying to cut a deal with them now.
A deal? I said.
Those smug bastards blackmailed a judge. Kaplan doesn't care. They've got something she wants, and she's willing to give away the store to get it.
Tell her to hold off. We'll be there in 15 minutes, I said. Kylie hit the accelerator, and the car lurched forward.
Or less.
7 minutes later, we walked into an interrogation room, where ADA Selma Kaplan was sitting with the two blackmailers and a woman in her late 30s with curly red hair and a pleasant smile.
This is Grace Marchand, Kaplan said, introducing us. I'm Troy's big sister, she said. I'm a personal injury lawyer, but my brother can't afford an expensive criminal attorney, and he doesn't trust public defenders, so here I am. Good thing for him, I watch a lot of Law and Order.
It was an act, and I didn't buy the fish-out-of-water routine for a second. If Grace Marchand were really out of her element, she'd be a wreck. This woman knew what she was doing, and I could see by the smirk on Dylan Fremont's face that she was doing it well. Selma Kaplan stood up.
I need a moment outside with my detectives.
Oh, take all the time you need, Marchand said. But I just want to tell you that both Troy and Dylan are really, really sorry about what they did, and they're giving back all of the money.
Is there any left? Kylie said. Because they went on a really, really big spending spree last weekend.
I know. Shameful,
Marchand said, looking at her brother, like he was a naughty puppy who'd soiled the carpet.
But they still have 84,000 left, and I'm going to make up the difference.
I must have missed the episode of Law and Order where the penalty for committing a Class D felony is giving back the money if you get caught, Kylie said. Your clients are looking at 7 years, Counselor.
Marchand smiled sweetly.
And yet Miss Kaplan has just offered to drop all charges.
Before we could say a word, Kaplan herded us out of the room.
Drop all charges? Kylie said as soon as we closed the door. Selma, what the hell have they got?
32 hidden camera sex tapes, every one of them starring Aubrey Davenport.
And who are her co-stars?
According to Miss, I don't know anything about criminal law. They are the pillars of the community. The CEO of an international bank, a congressman, a newscaster, a university chancellor, a laundry list of New York City's boldest boldface names.
So Troy Marchand had Aubrey's laptop all along.
No, that's still missing. Troy says he was cleaning the office one day and he stumbled on an external hard drive. He didn't know what it was, so he and Dylan screened the contents. Turns out that Aubrey spent over a year shooting the secret documentary. She wanted to expose these upstanding princes of industry as liars, cheaters, and sexual deviants.
You mean she wanted to blackmail them?
No, she was a dedicated filmmaker. She wasn't thinking about money. She wanted an Oscar. It was only after she was murdered that those two clowns realized they were sitting on a gold mine and went into the extortion business.
That calls for some jail time in my book, Kylie said. Offer them 3 years. They'll get out in 18 months, but at least they'll have...
Kaplan cut her off.
You think like a cop, MacDonald. The DA thinks like a politician. If those tapes ever saw the light of day, it would rock the city's establishment to the core. Forget about going to trial. I can't even charge them with anything, or it'll be on the public record.
So the DA is willing to cut them loose just to suppress those tapes, I said.
Zack, these are the people that Red is supposed to take care of.
Protect and defend, Selma, not cover up.
It's not your call, and it's not mine, Kaplan said. It's the DA's.
No doubt with some input from our politician-in-chief, Mayor Sykes, Kylie said. I bet every horn dog on those tapes donated generously to her campaign.
Sweetheart,
you've been at this long enough not to sound shocked. The mayor and the DA are simply protecting the hands that feed them.
Where is this external hard drive with all these damning videos now? I said.
Troy hid it in his mother's basement. We should have it in a few hours.
Then maybe there's an upside to all this, I said.
Please, Kaplan said.
I could use an upside.
Most likely the external hard drive is a backup, and the original videos are still on Aubrey's laptop. Do you think Troy and Dylan have it?
Troy swears that they don't, and I believe him. He'd be too scared to hang on to it. And Yannick Hoffman didn't have it either, I said. But somebody does.
The question is who?
We know that Aubrey always had it with her. So my best guess is that somebody found out about this secret documentary, killed her, took the laptop, and has no idea there's a second copy. And I'm betting it's one of the 32 men on those videos.
I guarantee you it's not the Honorable Michael J. Rafferty,
Kylie said, a wide grin on her face. There you go, I said. We've just narrowed down the suspect list to 31 of our fair city's most respected citizens. Chapter 55. It had taken less than 2 minutes to cut Nathan Hirsch free from that bomb, and more than 2 hours to fill out the investigative worksheets that detailed the incident.
If I'd have known that saving his life would involve so much paperwork, Kylie said, pushing her chair away from her desk, I'd have thought twice about flipping the switch on that cell jammer.
I doubt it, I said. Since when have you ever thought twice before pulling one of your crazy-ass stunts?
It wasn't a stunt. I got a court order.
Kylie, you can bullshit Barbara O'Brien, but don't bullshit me. I saw the signature at the bottom of that warrant. Rafferty's not a federal judge, so he must have sent his clerk across the street to the district court and had one of his cronies sign it. You couldn't possibly have gotten all that done before the fact.
Well, aren't you the crafty detective? What's important here, Zack, is that we saved a man's life.
Yes, and now that man is cuffed to a bed in Bellevue, his wife is filing for divorce, and the DA's office is charging him with a half-dozen white-collar crimes. So I guess you're right. It sounds like a win-win all the way around. How do you plan on celebrating?
CJ and I are going for dinner at the Mark.
Are you serious? The same hotel where the robbery took place?
They have an incredible restaurant in the lobby. The hotel manager invited everyone at the poker game to be his guest any time. Hey, do you and Cheryl want to join us?
Thanks, but Cheryl took the Amtrak down to Philadelphia for a conference. My victory dinner will be a solo affair. Sausage pizza, a six-pack of Blue Moon, and a Yankee game.
That sounds dreadful.
It did, but it was a lie. Not the Cheryl part, but everything else. Q had texted me earlier in the day and told me he had a lead on the two thugs who had chloroformed Bob Reitzfeld, tied him up, and escaped with $800,000. It was ironic that CJ would be returning to the scene of the crime on the very same night that I was working hard to connect him to it. As soon as Kylie left the office, I texted Q. Some of my informants like to give up the information they've got, take the money, and run. Not Q Lavish. He doesn't take money, and he enjoys turning our get-togethers into a social event. An hour later, we were at Num Wan Tea Parlor in Chinatown, sharing 8 different kinds of dumplings. Halfway through the meal, the waiter brought us an order of boiled chicken feet with black bean sauce, which I happily pushed over to Q's side of the table. The two boys who hit the poker game are Tariq Jessup and Garvey Jewel, Q said, picking up a turnip cake with his chopsticks and taking a bite.
You sure?
100%. I have a signed confession, he said, totally straight-faced. They're waiting for you to cuff them and stuff them.
Sorry, dumb question. Let me rephrase. What makes you think they're the perps?
Jessup and Jewel are 2 bottom-feeder hip-hop promoters. They troll the streets and the internet looking for any wannabe Kanye or Nicki Minaj who can keep a beat and chant a rhyme. They put together a show, package it to any low-end club that will take them on, then beat the bushes for friends, family, and anyone else they can get to line up behind the velvet rope.
So they're musical impresarios, I said.
Impresarios who get paid in watered-down drinks and a small percentage of the gate if they're lucky. There's a ladder in the music business, Zachary, and these brothers barely have 1 foot on the bottom rung.
And yet?
Are you familiar with Gansvoort PM? It's a club in the meatpacking district.
I've heard of it.
From Kylie. She was supposed to meet CJ there, but called it off when Aubrey Davenport's body turned up on Roosevelt Island. Now that's a club, Q said. Their music rocks the roof off the building, and so do their prices. But guess who was seen there the past 2 nights?
Jessup and Jewel.
Correct.
They had their mitts all over two women who were totally out of their league, and they traded up from rack vodka to bottles of Dom. These mofos never had that kind of money in their lives.
Is it possible they won it in a poker game?
Q picked up another chicken foot.
You sure you won't try one of these?
No, I'm more of a breast man. Do you know where I can find Jessup and Jewel?
They move around.
How about tonight? I said.
He gave me a wide grin and sank his teeth into the chicken foot.
Of course he knew. Q knows everything.
Chapter 56. After dinner, we polished off an order of sweet-fried sesame balls and two pots of bole tea while Q gave me everything he had on Jessup and Jewel. Then he helped me craft a cover story I never could have invented on my own.
It's a little over the top, I said. Can we make it more, I don't know, realistic?
You mean like the Nigerian prince scam? Zach, you know the old saying, you can't make this shit up? Sometimes the more unbelievable something is, the more people are willing to believe it.
You think they'll buy it?
You think you can sell it?
He fired back.
I shrugged. Early on, I worked undercover for narcotics. I remember my first day on the street. I hadn't showered or shaved for a week. My clothes were stained and raggedy. And I was totally convinced that I was the most authentic wreck of a junkie ever to try to make a buy. I approached the dealer, and the first thing he says to me is, "Take off your shoes." Q started laughing before I even got to the punchline.
"And I bet you had on a nice clean pair of socks," he said.
I nodded. Dumbass rookie mistake. After a year, I transferred out because I hated smelling like the inside of a dumpster. But by the time I left, I'd gotten pretty good at lying. I guess I'll find out if I still can pull it off.
Drug dealers are hard to con because they think everybody's a narc. Jessup and Jewel are two-bit hustlers who have no reason to suspect you're undercover. You'll do fine. Just act like the guy in those old westerns. You're Black Bart walking into the saloon.
More like Caucasian Bart, I said, but I get your point.
I paid the check and found a store in Chinatown that sold burner phones. Then I walked to Grand Street and took the D train uptown to the Bronx. It was a 45-minute ride, which gave me plenty of time to repeat my cover story to myself till it was second nature. I got off at Bedford Park Boulevard and walked another 8 blocks to Webster Avenue. The club was called Rattlesnake, if you could call it a club. It was more of a dive bar with a sandwich board on the sidewalk that said, "Live music tonight." There was no line, no velvet rope, just a guy in a muscle shirt sitting outside. He nodded at me and said,
"Welcome to the Snake, 2-drink minimum."
It was relatively crowded for a Tuesday night. Close to 100 people, most of whom checked out the white guy, then went back to what they were doing. I went to the bar, ordered a beer, and found a table near the back, as far from the music as possible. 2 minutes later, just as Q had predicted, a good-looking man with shoulder-length dreads and a black beard flecked with gray pulled up a chair and flashed me a warm, gracious smile.
"Garvey Jewel," he said. "You with the label?"
I barely looked up from my beer.
"No."
"You just into hip-hop?"
"Not a fan," I said.
"Then you in the wrong room," Jewel said,
his smile morphing into a challenge.
"And if you're here to cop some blow, you're really in the wrong room.
This place may look low rent, but the old lady who owns it keeps it clean. Nobody underage, nobody dealing. Just a bunch of people who come for the drinks and the music."
"I'm in the right room, but I didn't come for the music."
"Then why are you here?"
"Same reason I go to the parking lot at Home Depot when I'm looking for day workers."
"What kind of day work you talking about?"
"Night work, actually. Not too dangerous. And it pays well."
"How well?"
I bent low and leaned forward, clasping my hands on the table. This was the moment of truth, and I dug down, hoping to channel the gravitas of Al Pacino and the psychological instability of Christopher Walken. I dropped my voice to a whisper.
"More than you and your partner made last Wednesday night on the Upper East Side."
He pushed his chair away from the table, and his hand instinctively went to the waistband of his pants.
"You a cop?"
I didn't flinch.
Answer me this, Garvey. Do you think the NYPD heard about your little blind man's bluff game at the Mark Hotel? But there were no African-American cops around, so they sent one lone white guy up to the Bronx to arrest you? Or do you think maybe you bragged to some woman who was sucking your dick, and she told her friend, who told her friends, who told their friends, and it finally got back to me?
Fucking Inez, Jules said. She got a big mouth.
Q had been right. Guys like Jessup and Jewel won't be happy with a fat wad of money, he had told me. They need to impress people with how they got it. Let him think the leak came from a girlfriend.
What if he calls her on it? I said.
She'll deny it, Q said. But he won't believe her. He'll believe you.
Don't be mad at Inez, I said to Jewel. She brought us together, didn't she? Now, would you like to hear what I have to say, or should I leave?
Wait here,
he said, and walked toward the front of the room. 2 minutes later, he was back with his partner, who was wearing an Apple Watch on his wrist, just like the blind man in Reitzfeldt's story.
25 words or less, the new guy said, and it better be good.
Saturday night, I said. Serious poker game in Jersey. The buy-in is $150,000. I'll be on the inside. I'm gonna need some wood, Apple Watch said. He looked around, wondering why it stopped.
Nobody's listening. Keep going.
That was 25 words, I said. I was counting on my fingers.
You're a piece of work, he said, extending a hand. Tariq Jessup.
I shook his hand and dropped my next whopper. The name is Johnny Worcester, I said. My friends call me Johnny Flyboy.
You a pilot?
He said. Back in the day, a couple of gorillas came over to my apartment and tossed me over a 7th-floor balcony. I bounced off an awning and landed on a 300-pound doorman. I've been Johnny Flyboy ever since. The two of them laughed.
Okay, Mr. Flyboy, Jessup said. You just bought yourself a few thousand more words.
Tell us about this poker game. I told them all about it, and they hung on every word. I was their Nigerian prince.
Chapter 57. At 3 in the morning, Geraldo Segura put on his backpack and slipped out of his hotel on Sumner Place in Brooklyn. He stopped at an all-night market and bought a bottle of Poland Spring, 2 Kind bars, and the early editions of the New York Post and the Daily News. He ate the energy bars and drank the water as he walked to the Flushing Avenue station. Then he climbed the stairs to the elevated subway platform, caught an eastbound J train, and scanned the papers. A picture of the detective wielding a pair of bolt cutters to free Nathan Hirsch was on the front page of both. The Post headline said, "Hero Cop Saves Lying Lawyer." He turned the page and read the banner above the lead story. "Thai Boxing Champ is Hotel Bomber." There were 2 pictures of him, one from his high school yearbook, the other from his fighting days in Thailand. At this point, he looked like neither. He'd come to New York with a bag full of professional disguises, and for this outing, he'd aged himself 20 years, his head bald on top, with a fringe of mousy gray hair on each side. A matching beard obscured his face. The details in the article were sketchy, because the 911 tape had not yet been released, and Hirsch, who would have lied anyway, had been hauled off before the media could descend on him. The Daily News coverage was the same as the Post's, but the caption above his Muay Thai photo made him smile. "The most wanted man in New York." He carefully tore the page from the newspaper, folded it, and put it in the pocket of his windbreaker. He couldn't wait to show it to Jam. He remembered the day he met her. She had come to Klong Prem Prison not for the boxing, but to watch her older sister parade around the ring in a bikini, holding up a card announcing the number of the next round.
"You're from America?"
she asked him, after he'd won 4 matches that day. He smiled. She was cute.
"Yes, ma'am." "Who was your favorite president?" she asked.
"Abraham Lincoln."
"Then he's the one I'm going to read about,"
she said, flashing a bright smile.
"Thanks."
He was 22 at the time. Jam was only 12. She came back for his next match and told him she'd read 3 books about Lincoln.
"I cried when they shot him," she said. "What's your favorite book that you read when you were my age?"
"To Kill a Mockingbird by Harper Lee." And so the friendship took hold. Soon Jam would start visiting between boxing matches, and the prisoner and the schoolgirl would talk about literature, philosophy, history, and her favorite subject, America. "Whenever the girl comes," Pongrit Chumtasa instructed his guards, "let her in. She makes him a better fighter." That may or may not have been true, but by the time he was 28, Geraldo Segura had become Romran Sura, the best Muay Thai boxer in Southeast Asia, with his sights set on the rest of the world. Special prisoners are afforded special privileges. And one evening, Segura was given a hot shower and clean clothes and driven to Juntasa's house. A guard escorted Segura to the dining room, where the head of the Department of Corrections was standing next to a table set for 2.
"Romran Sura, your most recent victory at the World Combat Games has once again brought great honor to the kingdom," Juntasa announced. "As a reward, His Majesty has graciously reduced your sentence by another 7 years.
Segura silently did the math. He had been fighting for his freedom, and with this latest grant from the king, he would be out by the time he was 50 years old. He thanked his benefactor.
"I have one other gift," Juntasa said. He raised his hand, a door opened, and Jam Anatasu entered. "It is her 18th birthday," Juntasa said. "The age of consent. Enjoy your evening."
He left the room, and Segura stood there, barely able to breathe. Jam was a vision, a goddess in a white lace dress, her shimmering black hair cascading down to her bare shoulders, her lips parted in a shy smile, her smoldering eyes locked on his. She was no longer a child. She was a woman, the one he wanted to spend his life with, if only she was willing to wait. They dined, they drank, they talked, they laughed, and then they adjourned to a bedroom suite, where the air was filled with soft music and the scent of jasmine, and they made love by candlelight. The next morning he returned to prison. He never lost another fight, and with each new achievement, the king rewarded him by taking more time off his sentence. The conjugal visits continued, and over the next 10 years, he and Jam had 4 children. As the dream of a life together slowly became a reality, she took a job working in the American Embassy in Bangkok. She was the one who secured his passports, one that gave him easy entry into the U.S., and a second passport with a new identity for his new life. Their new life. He was too well known in Thailand to go back, and as much as he knew Jam would want to live in America, that was impossible. The plan was to meet her and the kids in Adelaide, Australia. Flynn Samuels had given him contacts. After putting his life on hold for 20 years, he was ready for a fresh start. But not yet. He still had 2 more people to see in New York. Princeton Wells was no doubt expecting him. But first, he had to pay a surprise visit to one of the most ruthless men in the city. The J train stopped at Broadway Junction, and Segura connected to the L, took it 6 stops, and got off at the Rockaway Parkway station in Canarsie. He tightened the straps of his backpack around his shoulders and started the mile-long walk to the Caraïbe Maquette on Rockaway Parkway. He had a gift for Malik Legrand, and he planned to deliver it personally.
Chapter 58.
"Good morning, handsome."
I looked up from my keyboard. It was Cheryl. I checked my watch. It was only 8:30.
"Hey," I said. "What the heck are you doing here?"
"Well, I was thinking you'd be happy to see me," she said. "But I guess I thought wrong."
I jumped out of my chair and gave her a hug.
"Of course I am. I just thought you were spending the day at that conference in Philadelphia."
"It was a total yawn. Then Captain Cates called this morning and asked me if I could come back. I caught a 6:30 train, and here I am."
Kylie was at her desk, taking it all in.
I don't know about Zack, she said, but I, for one, am thrilled you're here. It would have been even more fun if you'd been here last night.
Why? What happened?
You know the robbery we caught last week at the Mark Hotel?
Shelley Traeger's poker game, Cheryl said.
Did you find the guys who did it?
Just the opposite.
Shelley doesn't want us poking around. The hotel management is so grateful he's sweeping it under the rug that they offered us dinner at the Jean-Georges restaurant in the lobby. CJ and I went last night. The place was packed. The food was incredible. And it was free.
Guess who turned down an invitation to go with us?
Kylie pointed in my direction. I looked at Cheryl.
Hey, you were out of town.
I know, but the Mark restaurant?
I'd have gone if you were out of town. Tell her what you did instead, Kylie said.
I have a better idea, I said. Instead of standing here rehashing every detail of my pathetic evening, I'd rather be alone with my girlfriend so I can tell her how much I missed her.
Excuse us. I put my arm around Cheryl and walked her to the stairwell.
What's going on between you and Kylie?
She said as soon as we were alone.
Nothing.
Zack, I'm a cop and a shrink, so I get lied to every day.
I'm not lying to you. I may be leaving out some of the details, but...
So you're sticking to your story that you had a pathetic evening last night?
I may have exaggerated that one.
And when I asked, what's going on between you and Kylie, and you said, nothing, was that an exaggeration? Or were you just leaving out the details?
Maybe a little of both.
I don't know what's going on, but I'm starting to understand why you weren't happy to see me this morning.
Can I explain?
Go for it, she said.
They say the truth shall set you free.
Maybe so, but in this case, I was afraid that the truth would only dig me a deeper hole. So I started with a half-truth. I'm investigating Kylie's boyfriend, I said. I think he may be involved in that poker game robbery.
And this is something Kate's asked you to do? Cheryl said.
Nobody asked me. I see a crime, I try to solve it. I'm a cop.
A cop was trying to put his ex-girlfriend's new boyfriend in jail.
Bullshit! You think this is personal?
Zack, everything with you and Kylie is personal.
She's my partner. If CJ used her to get invited to that poker game, I think she'd want to know before he uses her again.
Did she ask you to protect her from CJ?
Of course not.
Maybe that's because she's a grown woman who can take care of herself. She's also a smart cop, which means if you suspect CJ because he's the new guy at the table, don't you think that thought might have crossed Kylie's mind as well?
I opened my mouth, but nothing came out. Cheryl kept going.
You say you're her partner, and you think she'd want to know if CJ were using her, and yet you lied to her last night about what you were up to. What happens if you catch him? Are you going to arrest him?
No. Shelley has already said he won't press charges.
So what do you think he'll do?
Knowing Shelley, he'll give the guy a chance to pay the money back and quietly slip out of town.
So CJ will be out of Kylie's life, Cheryl said. Mission accomplished, partner. You just better hope she never finds out that you're the one who got rid of him.
Clearly, the truth had not set me free. I'd only told Cheryl part of what I'd been up to, and all I'd managed to do was piss her off. The rest would have to wait.
We better get back to work, I said. Let's finish this up another time.
I opened the stairwell door, and we walked back into the squad room.
Good timing, Kylie said. Aubrey's hard drive is hooked up to a monitor. It's ready for us in the conference room.
I turned to Cheryl. I'm glad you're back. I'll see you tonight.
What do you mean tonight? I'm going with you now.
With us? We're going to screen Aubrey Davenport's video files.
I know. That's why Kate's called me this morning. You're two cops working a homicide where the victim had deep-rooted psychosexual disorders. Kate's thought it might help if an actual psychologist sat in and screened the videos with you.
Great idea, Kylie said, giving me a thumbs up. I followed my ex-girlfriend and my current girlfriend into the conference room so we could watch sex tapes together. It was definitely not the threesome of my dreams.
Chapter 59. Jason White, our resident computer genius, was waiting for us in the conference room. Normally, he's a high-energy guy with a passion for mountain bike racing, complex techno problems, and caffeine. but this morning he looked as joyless as a funeral director.
"Good morning, detectives, Dr. Robinson," he said. "Brace yourselves. It's going to be a long day."
"What have you got?" I said, taking a seat.
"Aubrey Davenport was making a documentary. From what we could piece together, she video-ambushed 32 different men. She used code names, but some of them, like Judge Rafferty, are immediately recognizable. Given a little time, I'm sure our facial recognition software can ID them all. We've organized the files according to date last opened. Every single one of them was opened after Aubrey's death."
"That would be our blackmailer's handiwork," Kylie said. "Can you tell if they edited anything?"
"They didn't," Jason said. "They just watched. The last file modified was Sunday, May 7th, the day before the murder. It's Aubrey's on-camera introduction to the film. It's only 2 minutes and 24 seconds long. The rest of the footage is Aubrey having sex with these men. None of it is pretty. It's still unedited and will take you about 14 hours to screen. Less time if you high-speed through it. More time if you get sick to your stomach and have to walk away from it."
"Let's start with the introduction," Cheryl said.
Jason double-clicked the file, and the screen faded to a shot of Aubrey Davenport sitting on a tall director's chair. She wore dark gray pants and a soft dove-gray cashmere sweater. Her hair, which had been matted with dirt when I saw her on Roosevelt Island, was a rich chestnut and fell to her shoulders in waves. Her eyes were bright and intelligent, and she had just enough makeup on to make her camera ready without looking made up. She was attractive, intense, and very much alive. She didn't introduce herself. She just started talking to the camera in a clear, confident voice.
"My sex addiction began at the age of 12, when I found my father's stash of porn tapes. At that age, I had a pretty good idea what sex was all about, but this wasn't that. This was much more interesting. Bondage, discipline, dominance, submission. My fascination was instantaneous, and I wanted to be like the women in those videos."
The camera began to drift in slowly.
"By 14, I'd had several flings, but they were with clumsy teenage boys who wanted nothing more than to stick their dicks in a hole. And then I found Brad Overton. He was 38, a film producer, and I was 16, an unpaid summer intern. Brad was handsome, powerful, and when he came on to me, I couldn't say no. I didn't want to say no. Not to the drugs, not to the physical pain, not to the degradation. This was the sex I'd been dreaming of. As I got drawn into her story, I realized the camera was pulling me in as well. It had moved to a medium shot and was continuing to drift closer still. When the summer was over, my job ended, and Brad replaced me with another girl. I spent the next 23 years trying to replace Brad. One man after another. Raging sadists who hurt me physically and emotionally, and all I could do was beg for more. Until one day..." She paused, and I held my breath. "Until one day," she repeated, "I didn't just want them to hurt me. I wanted them to kill me." At this point, the camera stopped moving. Aubrey's face filled the screen. Her eyes were moist. "I am an addict," she said, her voice cracking slightly. "A slave to my sexual addiction. This documentary is about men who prey on women like me. It's all shot with hidden cameras. I don't have to tell you their names. You'll know them. Watch them hurt and humiliate me. They'll think they're in control, but I'm the one with the power. I'm the one doing the humiliating."
She took one more long pause.
"I've been hurt enough," she said. "This film is how I will heal."
The screen went to black, and white type slowly faded up onto it. Sex Slave, a film by Aubrey Davenport. Chapter 60. Nobody said a word. Finally, Cheryl broke the silence.
"That poor woman. What a tortured life."
"Jason, how many of the men in these videos have you positively identified?" Kylie asked.
"9, Jason answered. "But we've only had the footage for a couple of hours. Give us a day and we'll ID them all."
"Do you know what Yannick Hoffman looks like?"
"The guy you arrested? Yeah, we looked for him. He's not in the mix."
Kylie looked at me.
Do you still think Yannick killed her?
There's plenty of circumstantial evidence, I said. Her car parked a block from his apartment is hard to ignore. Plus, he doesn't have an alibi.
He also doesn't have a motive.
You don't need a motive when you have a history of roid rage. Kylie, he beat her up bad in the past.
But this time she wasn't beat up, and the murder wasn't the result of a flash of rage. It was too well planned and executed. Aubrey caught 32 men on hidden camera, every one of whom had a better motive to kill her, steal her laptop, and make sure this documentary would never see the light of day.
If they knew it existed.
One of them did, Kylie said. Our job is to find out which one.
Or eliminate all 32 of them and keep trying to make a case that will convict Yannick.
Guys, it's going to be a long day, Cheryl said. Can you save the detective talk until after you actually know what you're talking about? She turned to Jason. Play the tapes, please. She shot the first one 14 months ago, Doc, Jason said. The latest is dated 2 weeks before she died. Start with the oldest one first, Cheryl said. There may be a narrative thread in there. On the other hand, it seemed more likely that the killer was a recent victim who caught Aubrey taping him and wasted no time eliminating her. But I wasn't going to argue with Cheryl. I'd pissed her off enough for one day. There was no thread, just a theme. Paraphilia. It's a shrink term for what most people would call really weird sex. Some of the men were much older than Aubrey, father figures, no big surprise. The rest of them were more age-appropriate, but they were all authority figures. A deputy police commissioner, a college professor, and of course, Judd Rafferty. The sex ran the gamut from standard fare softcore porn to the more exotic BDSM, to perversions I'd never heard of, much less seen. I'd have been uncomfortable watching it on my own, but sitting through it with my girlfriend to the right of me and my ex-girlfriend to the left made it excruciating. By noon, we'd waded through 15 videos. Should we send out for lunch? Jason asked.
I can't watch this and eat, I said. Let's walk over to Jerry's diner.
Let's watch one more, and we'll be halfway through, Cheryl said.
Good idea, I said.
The 16th film started like all the others. Aubrey had a pinhole camera in her shoulder bag that she'd turn on just before meeting up with her latest target. Then she'd give a brief, cryptic introduction. This one may be the biggest hypocrite of them all, Aubrey said. She was in an elevator. The doors opened. She walked down a hall and rang a doorbell. A man opened the door, but the camera was so close that all we could see was his shirt and tie. The two of them walked into a second room, and then Aubrey removed the bag from her shoulder and carefully set it down at table height so that the camera would pick up the entire room. Kylie and I both stood up. The man was not yet on camera, but we didn't need to see him to make a positive ID. The curtained windows, the upholstered furniture, and the deep red Persian rug all looked familiar. But the clincher was the giant poster of Dumbo, the flying elephant, hanging on the wall behind Dr. Morris Langford's desk. Cheryl leaned forward and pointed at the screen.
Zack, she said. I've been to that office.
We all have, I said. And then the man who told us how hard he had worked to help Aubrey overcome her addiction stepped into the frame, undid his belt, unzipped his fly, and let his pants drop to the floor.
On your knees, he said.
Chapter 61. I watched the video with my fists clenched. Of all the men who had taken advantage of Aubrey, Langford was the most despicable. For her, sex had to be loveless and punishing, he had told us. He had analyzed her addiction, and then privy to her darkest secrets, he made sure he gave her the high she was looking for.
Sick son of a bitch, Kylie said.
It proves he lied to us, but we still have to prove he killed her.
Shrinks don't shock easily, but Cheryl looked nothing short of horrified.
Are you okay? I said.
She rolled her eyes. Of course she wasn't okay. Langford was a colleague, a highly regarded sex therapist.
I could only imagine what she felt like watching him violate one of the basic moral principles set forth in the Code of Medical Ethics.
"We're about to go all detective on this case," I said. "Do you want to stay?"
She smiled.
"I'm fine, Zack. Well, maybe not fine. I'm sickened. But I'm not walking out on this."
"Let's start with his alibi," I said, flipping through my notebook. "Aubrey parked her car in the garage in Brooklyn at 4:52 p.m. on May 7th. I don't know how she got to Roosevelt Island, but most likely it was in Langford's car. It was rush hour, so she couldn't have gotten there much before 5:30. The body was called in shortly after 9:30. When I spoke to Langford the following day, he said he had been at a medical conference in Albany. But was he there during that four-hour window when Aubrey was murdered?"
"Was there even a conference?" Kylie said.
"Hold on." Jason began tapping away on his laptop. It took him a few seconds to come up with an answer.
"There was a substance abuse conference at the Albany Marriott on May 7th and 8th, he said.
"What's the number of the hotel?" Kylie asked. "We can call and find out when he checked in."
"We could do that," Jason said, "and hope that we could convince some hotel desk clerk to cooperate without a warrant. Or..." His fingers flew across the keys.
30 seconds later, he found what he was looking for.
"Or," he repeated, "we could check the good doctor's credit card charges and find out that he bought gas at the Plattekill rest stop on the New York State Thruway at 10:34 p.m. on May 7th, and he checked into the Albany Marriott at 12:10 a.m. on May 8th.
"It's a 3-hour drive from New York," Kylie said. "I'd like to check his GPS and see where he started from."
I turned to Cheryl.
"What's your take, Dr. Robinson?"
She took a deep breath and looked at the monitor. The screen was dark now, but the memory was vivid. Then she turned back to the group.
"I think we were wrong to assume that all the men on these videos had a strong motive for killing Aubrey," she said. "Judge Rafferty practically laughed it off. Most of the others would be subjected to public humiliation, but they'd bounce back. Men like that always do. People tend to be forgiving when politicians, sports heroes, and movie stars are caught up in a sex scandal. But they'd never forgive the one man Aubrey trusted to help her. Maury Langford's private practice, his hospital affiliations, his broadcast contracts would all disappear overnight. He'd be ruined. If you need a motive for murder that will stick with a jury, you've got one."
"In that case," I said, "I'm skipping lunch and the other 16 videos and paying Dr. Langford a house call."
"Let's do it," Kylie said, her adrenaline pumping.
A fired-up female cop, eager to race out the door to take down a repugnant male predator. Cheryl, of course, shared none of Kylie's enthusiasm.
"Good luck," she said,
her voice barely above a whisper, her eyes unable to hide the disillusionment she felt inside. "I'm sorry," I said. "I know how much you admired him."
"I did, and now I don't."
She took another deep breath.
"Great police work, detectives," she said,
her voice re-energized.
"Now go get the bastard."
Chapter 62.
"Is he good to go?"
Kylie asked as we sped across the 79th Street transverse. It was the classic question. Translation: do we have enough evidence to arrest him?
"No," I said. "The video doesn't prove he killed her, and the fact that his Albany alibi is full of holes doesn't put him on Roosevelt Island with Aubrey. All we can do is smile, be super polite, and ask him if he'd be so kind as to come back with us to the station and help us with our investigation."
"Super polite doesn't sound like me," Kylie said.
"Good call," I said. "Let me do the talking."
Kylie turned onto West End Avenue and parked the car in front of the same hydrant she'd blocked the week before. This time a doorman came running out of the building, waving his arms. He was about 30, tall, with large bony hands and a thin-lipped scowl on his face that looked like it was painted on permanently.
"You can't park there, lady," he yelled.
"Want to bet?"
she said, flashing her badge.
"So what's the deal?"
he said.
"You two cops are going to lunch for what, 2 hours? I need that space for people who are getting in and out of cabs."
"Relax, pal," I said. "We'll be out of here in 10 minutes. We're going to see one of your tenants."
"Which one?"
"We'd rather not be announced," Kylie said.
and I'd rather your car weren't blocking the front of my building. Life is full of disappointments, sweetheart. Which tenant?
I'd never seen him before. He hadn't been on the door the night we first visited Langford. But I knew the type. Somewhere along the way, he'd been soured on cops, and Kylie's in-your-face approach didn't help change his mind. Dr. Langford, I said. He flashed a victory scowl.
Your names?
We played the game and identified ourselves. He rang up.
No problem, doctor,
he said after a brief dialogue. Then he turned to us.
He's with a patient. I'll let you know when you can go up.
And what's your name, asshole? Kylie asked.
Eddie, with a Y, in case you're adding me to your Christmas card list. Now cool your jets outside. We have a no loitering in the lobby policy.
By the time he waved us in, 10 minutes later, Kylie was seething.
I'll be back for that punk-ass prick,
she said as we rode up in the elevator. Calm down, I said. Remember the deal. I do the talking. I rang the bell, and Langford cracked the door open.
Hate to bother you again, doctor, I said,
but it would speed up our investigation if you came down to the station and helped us out with a few more questions.
Could we do this another time? He said. I'm with a patient.
We can wait downstairs, I said. What time would work for you?
I have an impossible schedule, he said. Plus, I'm traveling this weekend. How about next Tuesday? How about now? Kylie said, shoving her way in front of me. If that doesn't work for your schedule, how about 5 minutes from now?
Excuse me, detective, he said, bristling. But I've already told you everything I know about Aubrey Davenport.
No, you haven't. Take a ride with us, and I'll prove it.
The doorman had pressed all Kylie's buttons, and she was unleashing her anger on Langford. I tried to get the situation back under control.
Dr. Langford, I'm sorry if we sound overly aggressive, I said. It's just that some new evidence has come to light, and it would help if we could share it with you. Are you sure you can't spare 20 minutes?
No. If you've got new evidence, send me an email. I'll get to it when I can. How about if we just put it on YouTube? Kylie said. We had an ace in the hole,
and Kylie was pissed enough to turn our cards face up. If Langford was our murderer, he'd have known about the video. And now he knew that we knew. I was pretty sure he'd slam the door in our faces. But I was wrong.
I'm sorry, he said. I've been under a lot of pressure. I very much want to help you catch Aubrey's killer. I'll go with you. Come in.
He opened the door and we entered his waiting room. I have a patient in my office. I can't just leave her there. We're in the middle of a hypnotherapy session.
Does that actually work? I said.
Oh, goodness, yes. It's highly effective at helping people change behaviors like smoking or nail biting. Also, a trained therapist can help people explore painful feelings and memories they may be hiding from their conscious mind. My patient is in a hypnotic state. Give me a few minutes to bring her out of it. He stepped into his inner office.
I don't get it, Kylie said.
Why is he suddenly being so cooperative?
Maybe it's because you threatened to ruin his career by going public with the video. Nice way to let me do the talking, McDonald.
And now you're bent out of shape because I got him to agree to come in for questioning? $100 says he cracks when we show him the video. Call Selma Kaplan. I want her behind the glass when he gives it up.
The inner door opened.
Detectives, please, step in, Langford said.
We walked in. I didn't see the woman in the chair by the door until we were on the opposite side of the room. She was attractive, in her mid-30s, sitting quietly with her purse on her lap.
This is Karen, Langford said.
She had a horrific childhood. She was raped repeatedly by her mother's boyfriend, Lucas, and Mom did nothing to stop it. She was powerless then. But she's much stronger now, aren't you, Karen? The woman nodded.
Now that your mother and that evil Lucas are back in your life, what are you going to do if they try to hurt you? Langford asked.
Kill them, Karen said, taking a gun from her purse and pointing it at me and Kylie. The shrink flashed us a devilish smile.
Oh, she will, he said. I'm an expert at suggestion therapy. If you so much as move from where you're standing now, Karen will shoot you dead.
Isn't that right, Karen?
That's right. I'll shoot them dead.
Mom, Langford said, pointing at Kylie, you've hurt your daughter enough, but now she has a newfound strength. Now he pointed his finger at me. As for you,